Dear listeners, Sai Ram and greetings from Prashant Nilayam. Welcome to our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's First Day Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai at 12:30 PM Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 5th November 2015. Have a listen, please.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's segment of Afternoon Satsang as part of the Thursday Live. This week we will be continuing where we left off last week. Last week we had taken up a topic titled The Basis of Life, and this was based on the Bhrigu-valli from the Taittiriya Upanishad. And we thank all our listeners for the very encouraging feedback that they have sent to us. A couple of you have written in such great detail that it really moved and overwhelmed us, both of us, Prem and myself. We felt so happy that these efforts that we put in were being appreciated, and we really felt like it was Swami giving us a pat on our back. We are grateful to that Swami. We are grateful to all of you for that. And as we said last week, this week too, we shall continue in that endeavor. We shall go through the Bhrigu-valli and try to discover the basis of life, Brahman as it is called. We shall move on to the second part. But before we do that, let me welcome Brother Prem onto the show. And again, let this disclaimer be clear that we are no experts here. We are just sharing our thoughts and our feelings and whatever we have been inspired with, having read the Bhrigu-valli, having gone through it, and having received so much of love and grace from our dear Swami. So with that, Sairam Prem, welcome.
Sairam Arvind. Yeah, I think how many times we say that we're not the experts in this field, it wouldn't be an overstatement, because as the definition of the word Vedanta means, you know, because all of Upanishads is from the Vedanta. And Vedanta is supposed to be the culmination of all the Vedas. You have the four Vedic texts, and that which is the essence of all this is Vedanta. And this Vedanta is further made concise into what we call as the Upanishads. You know, and that's how intense these texts are, and this is how pregnant with meaning and profundity these texts are. And it has come from a very, very dispassionate study, to say the least. Like, for instance, if you see the a parallel with it in the scientific field, you would see that most of these scientists will not hesitate to, you know, come to a conclusion and then say that, oh, I was wrong, I did not see this aspect of it. And to correct their findings, go back and rewrite. I was in fact reading a book by one of the biologists, and the book which I got was supposed to be the 7th or 8th edition. Okay. He was saying how many of these scientific books keep changing over editions because, you know, over the years of research, they better their understanding, they improve, and they even recognize and acknowledge the mistakes they've made. And it comes from that kind of a dispassionate desire to know what is the truth in whatever field you're studying.
In fact, I remember, if at all there is a scientific textbook that has remained unchanged, say, over the last 50 years, it is proclaimed with great pride, you know, because here is a scientific textbook that is referred to even today. That's how it is marketed, in the sense that it is very, very rare to have a book that remains unchanged over 50 years. So, yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying.
Very true. In fact, some of these Western philosophers who have studied the Upanishads, they've said that, you know, I mean, it was an eye-opener for them. Because when they saw this, it was such a detailed way of studying the phenomenon around you, what you experience in everyday life, that it was notches above, you know, contemporaries who were doing the same kind of thinking in the West. Even be it Plato, Aristotle, or Socrates, you know, who are supposed to be the pillars of Western philosophy. They said these people seem to be, like, you know, so much deeper. As we saw, we've just not even come to the midway of Sage Bhrigu's exploration of the self. But even in that, we saw what kind of profundity is there in the thought, where that conclusion that food is everything. You know, probably this is the summary of what we covered last time. You know, when he said that food is Atman, food is Brahman, food is one from which everything has come, everything returns to, and food is one which is always present.
Sustaining the
whole thing. You know, how profound a thought that was. It was not simply somebody who was very fond of food, or somebody who was seeing life very superficially. Even that had such deep thought, and we went into Swami's discourses, what he says. And then, of course, the second conclusion that he comes to is
that more subtle than food is actually the life force, the prana, and we went into details of the different kind of vayus or the vital airs, prana, apana, vyana, udana and samana, the five vital airs. We went into some detail of that and realized that that is subtler than food. And the thing is, once Bhrigu comes to his father Varuna and says that prana is the ultimate, Varuna says that good, but this is not the complete answer, go back and again do tapas. And we also, I think, discussed on tapas does not mean just sitting in a place. It is a combination of karma, bhakti and jnana, as Swami states, giving the analogy of the three hands of the clock. So tapas is a summum bonum of everything. It's not just about this act alone is tapas or that act alone is tapas. So we said that because we should not become complacent and give excuses for not doing work, saying that I am engaged in spiritual activity and therefore I will not work. In reality, a true spiritual aspirant is one of the hardest workers ever. So when Varuna tells Bhrigu to go and do tapas, Bhrigu goes and does his penance. Again, we have no idea of the time scale.
Probably one thing which we need to clarify, as you're saying about penances, I think most of our misconceptions is because of the portrayal of some of these things in our in our media and entertainment and things like that. Because if you read some of these old scriptures, it's not like somebody who is doing tapas does nothing but tapas. Tapas is something like you dedicate all your energies to exploring one particular aspect.
Exactly. You know, for example, when a scientist is hell-bent on organic chemistry, it is a tapas that he is doing.
Absolutely.
It's just in that it is in the field of organic chemistry.
And it doesn't mean that he does not do anything else.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean that he's just sitting there for years together, does not leave his laboratory. You know, when you say tapas, the sage doing tapas, that's the image which we get. Somebody who does not eat, somebody who does not sleep and does not do the other things which all of us do in everyday life.
And in light of what we are now discussing, Prem, I think a better definition of tapas, possibly a closer definition for tapas, would be priority. So when a scientist does tapas in organic chemistry, it just means that organic chemistry is his priority,
right,
which means
absolutely.
That he's ready to sacrifice other things for the sake of organic chemistry. But that doesn't mean that nothing else is there. His top priority is organic chemistry, and whatever he does in his life, for example, a research scholar who is researching on organic chemistry, all that he may do every time will be centered on organic chemistry because that is the top priority. So also for the case of Bhrigu here, his top priority is finding the basis of life. So his tapas is that. So his top priority becomes that. So it is not just about not doing anything else, but it's about defining your top priority.
Absolutely. And you know, the time that you took to give us that summary, I managed to get that quote which I was talking about. It's actually a quote of Max Muller. Swami would very often refer to him and his fondness to Indian culture. Now this is his very words, you know. It is surely astounding that such a system as Vedanta should have slowly been elaborated by the indefatigable and intrepid thinkers of India thousands of years ago. A system that even now makes us feel giddy as in mounting the last steps of the swaying spire of a Gothic cathedral. None of our philosophers, including Plato, Kant and Hegel, have ventured to erect such a spire. In the beginning there was but one, and in the end also there will be but one, whether we call it Atman or Brahman.
Wow.
These are the words of Max Muller, in awe of the kind of knowledge that the Upanishads present before us.
And the knowledge has been of such dizzying proportions that it is said that you better make this a top priority. That is why it is said you have to do tapas. You have to make this a top priority, and when you make this a top priority, you have to let go of everything else. If anything comes in the way of this pursuit, you have to give that up. And you have to dedicate yourself most of the times at the lotus feet of your master. That is why, in fact, you know, Swami would say that Upanishad, Upa means close, Ni means below, Shad means to sit. So Upanishad, when it's elaborated upon, it actually means to sit close and below what? Below the feet of a master. So that the knowledge flows. Swami would give the example of how water flows from a reservoir to the taps. Therefore, the reservoir always has to be on top and the taps are below. So too, he would say that for the flow of knowledge, one has to sit close to and below. Close to does not mean physical proximity. It means being attuned to one's master. And below does not mean, you know, sitting, putting the master on top on a bench and you sitting down. Below means to have humility, to know that you have to receive. So with humility, with attunement to the master, alone you will be able to get this Upanishadic knowledge. And I feel even the theoretical Upanishadic knowledge that we both profess, Prem, is because of our proximity and humbly accepting what Swami has given us.
That's the reason why this whole process becomes very scientific. And maybe in a sense, you know, if you look at it, probably this is outside the scope of this discussion, but what happens to somebody like Vyasa, right? In the end of it, he still feels something lacking. Probably we'll come to that even at the end of Bhrigu's exploration. But he finds something lacking because you have a phenomenon, you have a concept in front of you, and all the while, you are only trying to reach it or understand it through your intelligence. And all said and done, intelligence is not the only part of human beings. And when you're trying to look at something with only one tool that you have, all said and done, your knowledge will not be comprehensive. So even if you look at the highest wisdoms of the knowledge, like somebody would say, you know, the essence of the Veda is the Vedanta, essence of the Vedanta is the Upanishad. And each Upanishad is actually brought down to one Mahavakya. And that we have heard so many times from Swami. And that is like Tattvamasi or Aham Brahmasmi. I mean, yes, that is the final knowledge. And you know it. But does that matter to us? Does that change our lives? It doesn't, because we are not approaching this whole idea with all our faculty. And that is what happens when you actually approach it with devotion, when you have a personated God in front of you, a divinity in front of you, and you approach it with devotion. And that kind of draws everything that makes you feel with your heart, makes you think with your intellect, and reach it with your hands and your karma too.
And sanctify your senses with that same thing. See, that is what happens even to Bhrigu. So, rather than, you know, this point, just remind me if I forget. This we have to bring it up when we go to the penultimate stage.
Exactly.
Where how foolish it is to try to intellectually understand God alone. Because as you said, intellect is just one among many tools that have been gifted to us. So now what happens is, Bhrigu has gone and done tapas because he has realized that annam is not the ultimate. Prana, that is life force, is not the ultimate, because that's what his father has said. And then he thinks, he's in his tapas. At the end of the tapas, Bhrigu feels that now I've got the answer. Yes. So he comes running back to his father, he's excited, and he says, Dad, what you said was right, correct. Annam, pranam, okay, but now I think I've hit upon what is Brahman. I know what is the cause for creation, what sustains creation, and into which creation gets dissolved. I know that, and I think I was mistaken to think that pranam is the ultimate, because this is something subtler than life, subtler than the life force, subtler than prana. And I've got the answer, and this is what he tells his father.
Mano brahmeti vyajanat, manaso cheva khalvimani bhutani jayante, manasa jatani jivanti, mana prayanti abhisam vishamtiti, tad vignaya punareva varunam pitaramupasasara.
So he comes back and tells his father, Father, manas, or what we call loosely, means there are so many ways it can be interpreted as, there's a higher mind, the lower mind, whatever. Let us call it just the mind, manas as the mind. So he comes and says, Father, the mind is something that is subtler than prana, and mind is the cause for creation, mind is the cause for sustenance, mind is the cause for dissolution, and into the mind everything dissolves. So I think, Father, Brahman is the mind. This is what he says in great excitement. And, you know, if we look at the different ways in which mind is defined, one analogy that Swami gives of, you know, it comes to mind, if I can say so. And that is of the handkerchief. Swami would say that people tell me I'm not able to control the mind. I'm not able to control the mind. And Swami would say, mind is like this handkerchief. What is the handkerchief made up of? It is made up of threads. Swami would say the mind too is a fabric that is constituted by the threads of desire. And he would say, in order to make the mind go away, all you have to do is pull out the threads one by one. Once you pull out all the threads, there's no cloth at all. In the same manner, start eliminating desires. In fact, Swami would use this to emphasize on putting a ceiling on desires. We had done a satsang on the ceiling on desires program. So Swami would say, that's why at least start elimination of desires via ceiling on desires. So once you eliminate all the desires, the mind does not exist at all. So mind is nothing but a bundle of desires. And now when we see, we will realize that though it is the body that is constituted by annam or the gross, but it is actually animated by prana, life force. The reason for something to get animated by prana is because of desire. Whether it is a bacteria, whether it is a mammal, whether it's a bird, whether it's human being, the cause for birth is a desire. That holy union between the Purusha and Prakriti, or between the male and the female, the two genders, that is what causes this prana shakti to enter, you know, in the womb of a mother. Before anything happens, the first thing that happens is the fusion of the male and female reproductive cells, which give rise to that initial seed, the seed that is formed. So the precursor, or what causes this, is nothing but desire that has been built in. In animals it is there as instinct, and in humans it is there as the desire, that carnal desire that gives rise for life to spring forth. And therefore, though it is very subtle, it is subtler than prana shakti, it is actually the cause for life to originate. And that is why I feel, you know, Bhrigu also is confident that he has now arrived upon the right answer.
And the other thing, if you look at it, the basis of this understanding, that, you know, the idea that the mind is there, and that is the one which is more subtle and more permanent, you know, more than anything else, because the body is lying in front of you. The body which is made of food is there. And you know, the prana goes out, but what is it? Does life end with that, or there's a continuum for life? You know, that question. I think so the basis of that is the idea that you have something which is traveling from body to body, something which is undergoing an evolution physically at the same time internally. You know, that's the idea which actually is the basis of this. In fact, now, you know, there's a modern concept called YOLO. I don't know if you're aware of that. You only live once.
You only live once, yes.
Right? See, if you live with a concept such as that, probably you will not go deeper than the food and the prana. You'll only be thinking that as long as I live, I'll have to live with all the luxuries possible. And I have to an extent, maintain the health so that I live a healthy life, so that I can enjoy life. You will not go beyond that. And that is why, whenever Swami speaks about something like a concept like dharma, he speaks of two types of dharmas. The one is where the dharma related to your station in life. Swami refers to that as paradharma, right?
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And then he says swadharma or atmadharma. If you look at it, it's a very, very beautiful word. We use the word dharma even for religion in Sanskrit. Right? So any religion actually has two roles to play. One is, the word dharma itself means that which brings order. That is, if you have a group of men living in a society, you don't want somebody's freedom to affect somebody else's freedom. So you say, okay, these are the rules of the game. You do this, you don't do this. You know, you get punished for this, you get respected for this. So you bring something called a dharma so that there is order in the society. The other aspect, or the other side of dharma, is what is it that will take you from one birth to the other in a rising manner, in an ascending manner. That is beyond the social norms and social, you know, what will give you a comfortable living when you're alive. I think this is the basis of what Bhrigu is telling here, that, you know, something there is which is traveling from body to body, that is more subtler than food, that is more subtler than prana.
Exactly, because even in modern research, we see that, say, twins. In fact, I constantly keep quoting this in many talks, that one of the favorite examples that is the basis of the plot in many of the Bollywood movies in India,
right,
is that there are twins. One turns out to be the hero of the movie, one turns out to be the villain of the movie. And, you know,
exactly. I mean, if food is everything, they probably grew up eating the same food.
They drank the same mother's milk.
Same mother's milk.
And, you know, the environment, everything has remained same. Of course, you know, they may say that possibly they grew up in different environments. But, you know, there is something subtler than just the environment. Because if environment was the cause for nobility or evil, then a particular environment should give rise to only good, or right, a particular environment should give rise to only bad. For instance, if we look at the Satyasai Institute of High Learning in the hostel, you have been in the hostel, I have been in the hostel. Let's face it, I don't think all of us are equally noble. There are so many we look up to and think, wow, I wish we can be like them. There are also some we look down upon and say that, God knows how this guy is so evil or so bad, in the sense he's able to do that even in a place like this. We have people who are praised for their exemplary behavior. At the same time, we have people who read out apology letters now and then in a public forum for things that they have done that they should not have done. We see that. Having lived in a hostel, we have seen it. How is it that in the same system we have both coming like this? So it's not just about the environment. There is something deeper, subtler than the environment, though the environment can act as an accelerator or can act as a supporting factor. Suppose you have an inherent tendency towards evil, then the inherent tendency may get encouraged in an environment of evil. And that is what Swami used to say, that see, everybody has some good within each of them. And therefore, with the Satsang Institute of High Learning, I am building an environment that will foster the good. So it is not as if at the end of it, everybody will be on par at one level. But to the extent of whatever good exists in each individual, that good will get nourishment and fostered. So more good is there, you will see more acceleration in that. Less good is there, you will see an acceleration in that. Basically, an environment can only support what already exists. But what is it that already exists? In our culture, in our Bharatiya scriptures, we believe that each and every life is nothing but a continuum of what was left before, and there is future life, there is rebirth. So therefore, in discourses also Swami has said, where it is a mind that travels, and therefore be careful of your desires. Because you know, your desires, if they are not fulfilled in this birth, they will come and taunt you in the next birth. In the same way, the good that you do, that is one more thing Swami used to say to encourage people to do good. In case the good you do, you don't see the reward coming now, don't worry, because life does not end with death. Life goes on. And there is no way. If you plant a lemon seed, you will get a lemon tree. If you plant a mango seed, you will get a mango tree. You will enjoy the sweet mango. There is no escape from this. This is a, you know, rock solid rule that can't be broken. So therefore, do good even if you are not seeing the reward in this birth. Don't do evil even if you think that you are escaping punishment in this birth, because there is no escape from either good or bad. And therefore, there is something that is beyond life, subtler than life, that exists across lifetimes. And that is the mind, what we call as the vasanas or impressions, which get carried on from birth to birth. And therefore, Bhrigu comes and, as you said, you know, he says that, Dad, something subtler than life is manas. Manas, which is a bundle of desires. Because this gets carried on across lifetimes.
Exactly. You know, there is a very, very strong relationship between desire and, you know, what you call as the mind or the vasanas or whatever it is. As you're saying that, you know, so beautifully Swami said, mind is nothing but a bundle of desires. I was once listening to a talk by a person, I think he calls himself a mythologist. He was telling about this incident of Alexander the Great coming to the Indian subcontinent. Right, he's come all the way from Macedonia in Greece, and he's coming through these Persian deserts. And all the while, you know, he's seeing immense richness all this while, but all the while he's going on hearing stories and tales about India. Saying India is the most richest land and the most fertile. The kingdoms are so peaceful. I mean, there is nothing like dearth in this land. So he's always kept his mind on conquering India and going beyond. His idea is to conquer the whole world. So he comes there, and they say that there is it's a legend that he meets a sadhu. Okay, and this sadhu is sitting there without any clothes. He's sitting on the banks of a river and he's just looking at the sky. Okay. And this person was talking about them. He was saying that here is Alexander who wants to conquer the world. And here is the sadhu who has no interest in the world. So if you look at these two, these are two types of desires or two types of manifestations of desires. Okay, this one guy likes to do something, the other guy likes to do nothing. Okay, so what is the difference? What drives that difference between these two? And he says, according to Greek mythology, you know, it is believed that there is this river Styx or Styx or whatever you call that. According to Greek mythology, at the end of death, you come to the banks of this river and you will be asked, you know, what are the greatest deeds that you have done? So if you have done deeds which are tremendous, you will be sent to a heaven which is meant for special people, or you will be sent to a heaven which is meant for commoners. So this is the, you know, the belief in that particular mythology from where Alexander's beliefs come. So all his life he is growing with the idea that I need to have enough achievements to show at the river Styx. Okay, so that is what has driven his whole life. But here is the sadhu. His belief is probably there's a river, probably there's an ocean. At death you cross it, but again you cross back. Then again you cross it, again you cross back. So he says, whatever I carry at this banks, I have to leave it behind. So what is the point of carrying anything? So the basis of the, you know, the desire is so different. Here is one person who says that what I carry with me matters. And here is a person who is saying that whatever I carry, I'm going to leave it back and I'm going to start again. So what is the point in what I'm carrying? What can I carry which I can carry with me all through?
That's a real beautiful thought. And I feel towards the end of his life, Swami often narrates the story of how Alexander wanted his coffin to have, you know, two holes on the sides so that his arms can be stretched out from that. to say that the great Alexander who conquered the world leaves without taking anything with him. So I think that is a very important question for us to ponder on as to what is it that I can carry that stays with me across lifetimes. And as we are seeing, apparently the mind travels, and the mind has the ability to either make us or break us. Isn't that why Swami would exhort often in discourses saying, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo, meaning mind alone. Eva means alone. Mind alone, manushyanam, of man. The mind of man alone is the cause, karanam, for bandha and moksha. Bandha meaning bondage, moksha meaning liberation. Swami would give the analogy of a lock, and he would say the mind is like the key. If you turn it right towards God, it gets unlocked. You get freed, gets liberated. If you turn it left towards the world, you get locked, bondage. So he would say, see, the mind is the key. You turn it in the correct direction, you get freedom. You turn it in the wrong direction, you get bondage. So therefore, mind definitely is the cause for everything. It stays across lifetimes. It never is destroyed. It never seems to, means I don't know where we can find the origin of the mind. The mind is, seems to have been there forever, because even as I was born, I had a mind. That's what brought in my vasanas. That is what brought in my traits, my likes, my dislikes. And based on how I'm using my mind now, which exists with me even to this day, I hope, because I don't think I'm a mindless person, but my mind, it exists with me now. And even after I die, my next birth is going to be decided by how I've used my mind in this birth and my births before. So mind seems to have a permanent existence, unlike the body and the life force which arrives and leaves. So therefore, the mind is the basis of everything, it appears. But in order to strengthen this, I remember, I think you must have also read, come across this. There is this story in the Shirdi Sai Satcharitra.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, it is a chapter 47. It is a story of Veerabhadrappa and Chennabasappa. And Shirdi Baba himself is narrating the story. He says that one day as he was walking along the banks of a stream or a rivulet, he decides that it's time for rest and he sits down. He sits down and, you know, we know that Shirdi Baba used to love smoking the chillam. So he decides to light his pipe, and therefore he gets a little fire going. In the meanwhile, a passerby comes there, greets him, accosts him. He realizes that this is a spiritual personage, and therefore he invites Shirdi Baba to join him for lunch. And Shirdi Baba says that even as they are having lunch, they hear the painful croaking of a frog, and the other person is disturbed. He says, what is this? And Shirdi Baba says, nothing to worry about. It is just the frog paying back its karmas. It's for its sinful acts. So this man is a little, you know, intrigued. But because Shirdi Baba said this and he has reassured him in that manner, he continues to sit. But the croaking continues persistently and painfully. Now the person gets agitated and he says, so because of its sinful acts, is that frog going to die now? And that is when, you know, Shirdi Baba, you know, like parts the clouds and allows him to peek at the sun, as they say metaphorically. Shirdi Baba says, when I, its father, you know, it's a strange statement. How can Shirdi Baba, a man, be the father of a frog? But here he's speaking of the brotherhood of creation and the fatherhood of God. So Shirdi Baba says, when I, its father, is close by, how can the frog perish? I am there to protect. I have given a promise and I will protect. And Shirdi Baba gets up and walks towards that spot. The man also follows because he wants to see what's going to happen. And Shirdi Baba says, oh Veerabhadrappa, because of your sins, you got into this birth as a snake. So too, because of the sins of Chennabasappa, of Basappa, he has become a frog. Will you still not give up your enmity, and will you still continue after having fallen down in your birth like this also? And even as Shirdi Baba makes this statement, the snake lets go of the frog. The snake goes away in one bush, the frog hops away into another bush, and that's it. And this man is like really intrigued now. He tells to Shirdi Baba, Baba, what is this? What is this story? What is this Chennabasappa? What is this Veerabhadrappa? What is happening? And that is when, I think in the Shirdi Sai Satcharitra it is there, Shirdi Baba reveals the story behind. It's amazing to hear the story because it also shows how our tendencies in one birth transmit across to several births.
And from the story, let's hope we can do some justice to this really complicated story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very nice one too. You know, there is this particular town where they have a temple of Lord Shiva. Mm-hmm. And the people of that town decide that we need to renovate this temple. So they go around the village, they collect money from all the villages in order to get this temple renovated. And they give this renovation job to one of the rich people in that town. You know, because he is a person who is respected for his affluence. They believe he will have the funds at his disposal and he will get the work done. But he turns out to be a miser. And he, I think, commissions people who are not worth the task. And the work progresses very slowly. And he also embezzles a lot of funds. Mm-hmm. And in the process, the villagers keep coming and asking, why are you doing this? You know, why you get the work done faster? So he's a very sweet-tongued person who gets his way out every time through his words. But one day, his wife has a dream. Okay, and in this dream, Lord Mahadeva comes and he says, you know, get my dome done. You know, the dome of the temple. If you get it done, whatever you spend, you will get 100 times more from that. Okay, so she wakes up and next morning she tells the husband that this is what Lord Shiva told me and I think we should get it done.
A small interruption here. I just feel that that's such a powerful message, you know, that whatever you do for God comes back to you 100,000-fold. I don't think Mahadeva has to come in your dream and tell that to you.
Absolutely.
It holds good always in life.
Right. So she goes and tells her husband that, you know, this is what the Lord told me. The husband is first taken aback and he's, you know, kind of interested in the deal. But then he says that even for that 100 times, I need to make an investment. And it's like a blind investment. You're not sure they're going to get it back. So he's not very keen. So he tells that, see, if really Lord Shiva wanted me to do this, he would have told in my dream. He wouldn't have told in your dream. And he said that, you know, there is somebody who is trying to create some rift between you and me. So just, it's a bad dream. Just leave it. So the lady also forgets it. And this man continues with his funds embezzlement. I think they go around collecting some more subscriptions and they get collect more money.
In the meanwhile, what has happened is there is one old lady who has mortgaged her land to this moneylender. And because she's not able to pay it off, the land is still under his control. Now, in the meanwhile, what happens, I feel it very interesting in our modern day, present day context also, is that Mahadeva goes again in the dream of this lady. Possibly this man was not blessed enough to have Mahadeva in his dream. But Mahadeva goes into the dream of this lady and tells her that, see, if your husband is not ready to give money, no need, don't ask anybody. Don't ask any funds, because Shirdi Baba says, I am happy with whatever little is given with the right intention. I am not interested in the quantum of wealth. See, I feel in the present day context where people are laundering money by going and telling that Swami came in my dream, Swami told this, Swami did this in a vision, and therefore you should do. You know, while reading the beginning of the story, one often feels that, hey, you see, actually Mahadeva went in her dream. Lord Shiva went in her dream. But the husband is not listening. The husband is a fool there. But then what Lord Shiva does is amazing. He goes and tells in a dream that no need of your husband. No need. You don't seek any wealth from anybody. Whatever little you have, that you do. You know, again, I feel even in this incident, it is so strongly highlighted that one's connection with God is a very personal and one-to-one. So if anybody comes to me telling that Swami told me in the dream, this is what it is, I will tell them to get out. Because if Mahadeva wants, if Swami wants, he can come in my dream. He will tell me. Because here also, if Shiva tells her that if he is not listening, don't force him. Whatever little you have, use that. And with that, you try to get the work done. I'll be happy. And Shirdi Baba also in the Satcharitra states that God is pleased with the intention behind the act, not the quantum of the act. And therefore, the wife decides that in her own way possible, whatever she can, she will pawn her jewelry and try to get the temple building completed.
Right. So she decides actually to pawn the jewelry that has come from her father, which is by right her property and not her husband's. But again, the husband comes and plays a trick here. He says that anyway, you're going to pawn it to somebody. And I think he must be the richest man who has so much money in his disposal that the husband says that you pawn it to me only. You give it to me and I'll buy the jewelry from you. And he undervalues the jewelry. First thing he does is he undervalues the jewelry. He says it's worth only 1,000 rupees. And then he says, I will not give you this 1,000 rupees in cash. I'll give it to you as in land, as an endowment to the temple. This 1 acre of land. And which is the land he gives? He gives the land which belongs to this poor lady. I think her name is Dubaki.
Dubaki.
Yeah,
okay.
Dubaki. Dubaki is that poor lady who has pawned her land. So he takes this land which is not his and gives it to the temple, saying that instead of this jewelry, which is already undervalued, and he plays this trick.
And time passes, the temple is not built, the lady dies, the miser priest, her husband dies, and Dubaki also dies. And then the story continues.
Right. And then Shirdi Baba says that in the next birth, this miser is born as a Brahmin. Okay, and
Veerabhadrappa.
Right, Veerabhadrappa. And the wife is born as the daughter of the temple priest of that land. Okay, and this Dubhaki is born as one of the attendants in the temple, or one of the people who are in charge of taking care of the temple.
And his name is Channabasappa.
And then the story goes that he says this daughter's father, this daughter who is named Gauri now, comes to Shirdi Baba in seeking a blessing that she should find a good husband. So then Shirdi Baba says that, you know, husband will come searching to your house and she will find the right match. So this man, Veerabhadrappa, who is a Brahmin now, comes begging to their house, you know, as it is the right of a Brahmin to ask for alms. So that is where this father gets the idea that probably this is the man that Shirdi Baba said will be the man for Gauri. So then Shirdi Baba says that with my blessing, they both of them get married.
See, already we can see the connection. The same husband-wife become husband-wife even in this birth.
Right. And again in this birth too, the same situation arises where there is this temple's funds which have to be used for the betterment of the temple.
Hmm.
But now the temple's funds are actually under the care of Gauri, the daughter of the priest. And Veerabhadrappa, who is the husband, has actually nothing to do with the money which has been collected.
Hmm.
Right. Again, the similar situation arises, and when this lady comes to Shirdi Baba, Shirdi Baba says that, see, keep your husband out of it because he has got nothing to do with the money. The money is yours, so you spend it judiciously.
And for the betterment of the temple, Channabasappa, who is the attendant, actually right. serving sincerely at the temple, Shirdi Baba says that you can hire him and you can have others also working for the betterment of the temple. So a part of the funds you can use as capital expenditure to improve the temple. The remaining part you can use it for recurring expenses, which is to sustain the temple and the attendants who are taking care.
Right, and in fact the story Shirdi Baba gives the breakup, you know, the interest should be given for this and the main should be given to this and
the particulars,
right,
okay.
Some details like that. And again in this life too, she again gets a dream in which Lord Mahadeva comes and tells her that you listen to whatever the fakir in the masjid says.
That is Shirdi Baba.
You take his advice. So again, this is the same thing which Shirdi Baba says, that keep your husband out of it, but take the help of...
If I can again interrupt you, Prem, again, you know, I feel another strong message for the current day situation. See, initially she is devoted to Lord Mahadeva. Even across lifetimes it continues. And now she has not changed her loyalty by listening to Shirdi Baba. She is listening to Shirdi Baba because Mahadeva told her to listen, okay? And I feel it should be the same with us also. Having devoted ourselves to Swami, we listen to Swami alone, and even if Shiva comes and tells me, I will not, unless Swami tells, listen to Shiva, or unless Shiva comes as Swami. So therefore I feel, till we reach an Advaitic state, we have to hold on with all loyalty to the name and form to which we have held on so far.
Right, and as the story goes that the husband is very wild, he wants possession of the money, and the same trait that which was shown in the previous birth.
Greed for money.
In fact, Shirdi Baba says that even after he got him married, he was devoted to Shirdi Baba only because he made this marriage possible. But all through he used to come and ask Shirdi Baba only for the blessings of becoming more rich. So he could not resist this idea of, you know, money being under the disposal of his wife and he not being able to lay his hands on it. So when this lady Gauri was very helpless, she again comes to Shirdi Baba and she says that, I don't know what to do, my husband is not listening to me. And just as she's saying this, the two men, Veerabhadrappa and Channabasappa, come into Baba's presence and they're fighting with each other. Where Veerabhadrappa says that, I'm going to kill this fellow, I'm going to cut him into many pieces and all that. And Shirdi Baba, you know, separates them and asks them to forgive each other. And Shirdi Baba says that these two men, Veerabhadrappa and Channabasappa, are born as the snake and the frog.
In fact, at that point, Channabasappa goes and seeks protection. He's a little meek. See, that meekness also looks like the traits inherited from Dubhaki, previous birth, that lady who had pawned her land. So he's very meek, and Shirdi Baba says, come what may, I'll protect you. And that kind of animosity, hatred results in them becoming natural enemies. Just imagine, to a human, you can never be a natural enemy because humans are not like that. But a snake and frog are natural enemies. That's what happens. And because Channabasappa is a timid guy, he becomes the frog and Veerabhadrappa is a snake, and has the desire had arisen, you know. That is why the desires are so important. They travel across birth. He had told, I'm going to cut you to pieces and kill you. That is what the snake is doing to the frog here, trying to cut it into pieces and kill it. And Shirdi Baba, again, the beautiful conclusion that the Sacharita gives is that once you've taken refuge under the Lord, it's not just for this birth. It is for births, lifetimes. The deal is sealed. So Shirdi Baba comes and saves Channabasappa from that. And this is an interesting, very nice revelation in the Shirdi Sai Satcharitra, which further strengthens the discovery of Bhrigu, that the mind, the desire, mind which is a bundle of desires, mano brahme divya jana, that is the basis of everything, which is subtler than body and prana also.
Right, and as it's the ability to travel from birth to birth, I think many times Swami has also said this, that you know, the body dies, the prana leaves the body, but the mind actually carries all that has been picked up in the birth and carries it forward to another birth. And Swami also says that how part of it goes into the subconscious mind, that still, you know, makes us make some decisions. We don't realize that, as you're saying, that as you initially said, two children being brought up in the same family. In fact, sometimes it's even twins. Mm. But their desires are different. Their ambitions are different. The choices they make in given situations are different. It can only mean there is something different, something more than just upbringing and the food that they intake. So I think it's a solid conclusion that he has come to. But the father says, you know, continue to do tapas.
Before we go to that prem, I think we'll take a little break. Dear listeners, here is a wonderful song sung in the voice of Anoop Jalota ji. And it's a beautiful song in the sense it says how the body and life is the same that God gives to all. Yet it is man who chooses to defile. He compares the body to a sheet of cloth or a shawl or a bed sheet, you know. He says that is given equally to one and all. But some people choose to, you know, sanctify the cloth, some others dirty the cloth, majority dirty the cloth because of the kinds of desires that they entertain. So we'll take a break, we'll listen to this beautiful song and we'll be back. Don't go away, because today we are definitely going to conclude with the conclusion that Bhrigu arrived at.
ऐसी करनी कर चलो हम हंसे जग रोए शरीर को एक चादर के समान समझते हुए कबीरदास जी कहते हैं चदरिया हरे चदरिया हो रे चदरिया हरे चदरिया जीनी रे जीनी जीनी रे जीनी के राम नाम रस धीनी चदरिया झीनी रे झीनी के राम नाम रस धीनी चदरिया झीनी रे झीनी शरीर रूपी चादर है कैसे बनी यह चादर अष्ट कमल का चरखा बनाया पांच तत्व की पूनी अष्ट कमल का चरखा बनाया पांच तत्व की पूनी नौ दस मास बुनन को लागे नौ दस मास बुनन को लागे मूरख मैली गिनी चदरिया झीनी रे झीनी 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 राम नाम रस गिनी चदरिया झीनी रे झीनी जब मुरी चादर बन घर आई रंगरेज को दीनी जब मुरी चादर बन घर आई रंगरेज को दीनी ऐसा रंग रंगा रंग रे ने ऐसा रंग रंगा रंग रे ने के लालो लाल कर दीनी चदरिया झीनी रे झीनी 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 राम नाम रस भीनी छवरिया जीनी रे जीनी इन पंक्तियों में कबीरदास जी ने एक चेतावनी दी है, शिक्षा दी है। चादर ओढ़ शंका मत करियो, चादर ओढ़ शंका मत करियो, ये दो दिन तुमको दीनी चदरिया, ये दो दिन तुमको दीनी। मूरख लोग भेद नहीं जाने, मूरख लोग भेद नहीं जाने, दिन दिन मैली कीनी चदरिया जीनी रे जीनी 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 राम नाम रस भीनी चदरिया जीनी रे जीनी। ध्रुव प्रहलाद सुदामन ओढ़ी चदरिया, ध्रुव प्रहलाद सुदामन ओढ़ी, ध्रुव प्रहलाद सुदामन ओढ़ी, सुखदेव ने निर्मल कीनी, दास कबीर दास कबीर ने ऐसी ओढ़ी, दास कबीर ने ऐसी ओढ़ी, ज्यों की त्यों धर दीनी चदरिया जीनी रे जीनी 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 राम नाम के राम नाम के राम नाम के राम नाम रस दीनी चदरिया जीनी रे जीनी जीनी रे जीनी जीनी रे जीनी।
So that was the song by the famous singer Anup Jalota. I think he performed this song when he was here in 2011 during the birthday celebrations. But coming back to our discussion, it's difficult to overrule this conclusion which Bhrigu has come to, because as we saw that mind is such a powerful instrument and seems to be so universal and so ubiquitous. I mean, it kind of fits that description which Sage Varuna gives him, that, you know, this is something from which everything comes, everything goes back to it, and this sustains everything. So clearly mind seems to be something which is there, but I think a debate which often comes up, you know, is there anything called free will or everything is destined? So I think by saying that the mind and the desires that you carry in it decides everything that you choose in your life would kind of hint towards the idea that none of us are free at all. We are just going automated in our life. But I think if that is the case, a question which everybody asks is, then why do avatars come? Why do great masters come? Why do they try to counsel us? Why do they try to correct us?
In fact, you know, the other problem with accepting mind as the ultimate basis of everything is that, as Shirdi Baba showed it in that incident, as Swami says about planting a lemon seed and getting a lemon fruit, is that there seems to be a, you know, irrevocable connection, a thing that can't be broken, which is an action leads to a reaction. So you do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. Which means the only possible ultimate option for all of us is to just do good. Why? Because you'll be rewarded with good. It still does not free us from these cycles of life and death, because even if you continue to do only good, you're not liberated. Swami would often compare bad deeds, the bad karmas, to an iron chain. And he would compare good deeds to a golden chain. The fact is that you may be having a golden chain, but still you are chained. You are still bound. How is it that you are going to liberate yourself from the chains? Once you reach a stage where, you know, you realize that in the beginning gold chain appears more attractive than an iron chain. But once you are chained, you realize that whether gold or iron, the pain is the same. It doesn't, no longer depends on the quality of the chain, it comes back to the pain. If you have to totally give up the pain, you have to give up the chain. Whether it's iron or gold, it doesn't matter. So the problem with having mind as the ultimate is, I'm still bound. I don't want an iron chain, I don't want a golden chain. Oh, but, you know, the mind doesn't seem to have an answer. Because if you do good, I'll give you a gold chain. If you do bad, I'll give you an iron chain. But boss, I don't want a chain. I want to be free. Oh, then I don't know. That is why Varuna tells Bhrigu that, good, your answer is better than what you had come up with before, but it's not the ultimate. Go and do tapas. And that's what he does.
And the other thing, talking about our vasanas completely ruling us. If you look at the evolution, that is the case with animals. You know, with animals, 95 or 99% of their life activity is already pre-programmed in their head. You know, they have a particular season where they procreate. They have a particular kind of things they do when they're hungry, when they're scared, when they're, like, you look at a snake. The snake's reaction when it is scared is to strike, right? Or another meeker animal, which is when it's under threat, it flees. These are things which are programmed in the mind. You know, when it is hungry, they say that, you know, even a particular animal, however hungry it may be, it will not go in search of a different kind of food than which is programmed to eat. But we see that as we grow into the human species, there is this choice of driven by instinct, but there is also a choice of what I want to do. You can choose over one thing over the other.
I think that is what exactly Bhrigu discovers as he does his penance, and he comes running to his father and says, Dad, I've got the secret now. And this is what he says.
Vijnanam brahmeti vyajanat vijnanajeva khalvimani bhutani jayante vijnanena jatani jivanti vijnanam prayantyabhisam vishamtiti tad vijnaya punareva varunam pitaramupasasara.
You know, Prem, you were saying that about 95% of an animal's life is programmed. I beg to differ. I feel 100% is programmed. I don't think a tiger does anything other than by instinct. At least we don't see any other animal. The only animal possibly is man. And that's why, you know, man is considered as the crest jewel of creation. You know, the shloka that we just heard, the Vedic chant that we heard, is Bhrigu coming back and telling his father that, Father, vijnanam, knowledge, intellect, discrimination, that is what is subtler than desire. It is actually this discrimination that gives rise to creation, that sustains creation and destroys creation. Because though we say that desire is the one that leads to creation, man has the ability to discriminate whether he wants to entertain that desire or not. And that is why man is considered more divine than all other, you know, animals, in the sense that if you kill an animal, the punishment that you face is far less compared to when you kill a human being. Why is that? Because though we are not able to exactly say why, in the sense, it's not in terms of the blood or in terms of the body, in terms of the life breath, these are all common across in terms of desires. You know, Swami would often put this question, what is the difference between an animal and a man? It also has desire for procreation, for eating, for sleeping, and it does without education. And you're also having the same desire and you're doing that with education. Is that all education is meant for? It doesn't differentiate you from an animal because you're doing just what an animal does. Because Swami would try to put into us the thought and the truth that education is meant to flower this discrimination in us. The ability to choose between what desire you want to entertain and what you don't want to. And that is why man is considered as a very special creature, because he can choose not to have food, go do upavas, do fasting. You'll never see a cat or dog doing upavas. When it's hungry, it eats. A man can choose to give up sleep in order to pursue, say, God or pursue his job at office. You'll never see an animal doing that. So this ability to discriminate between desires and choose which desire has to be executed and which should not be, is that intellect or jnana, vijnana, that is subtler, and that is what is the basis for everything. That is what Bhrigu comes and tells his father.
And it's precisely what Lord Krishna tells Arjuna. When he asks him, I mean, I don't know exactly which is that verse, but I heard it in a commentary of the Gita, where Arjuna asks him, you know, everything is ruled by my vasanas. Everything is ruled by what I've desired for and what I've yearned for. And Swami would say that, you know, you have a burning desire over many births, and without your knowledge, your mind drives you in that direction. So then Arjuna says, then, I mean, what are we talking about? What are we sitting here and talking about dharma for? If everything is going to be propelled by my vasanas, then there's nothing in my control. So then Krishna tells him that, you know, there is a small part which can be manipulated, and all of sadhana and all of spirituality is actually working on that. And that is ruled by your buddhi, your ability to choose, your ability to discriminate. And the whole thing is trying to empower that ability in man. you know, we talk of Ramayana and the subtle meanings in the Ramayana. There is this incident, I think we've spoken about this inner significance of this incident, where Ravana is actually in a frenzy, you know, he's going around defeating all the kings and all the people ruling over many realms. He defeats the Navagrahas, that's one of the things they say.
The nine planets.
Right. Now. Then finally he goes to Lord Yama. Okay, Lord Yama is there and he goes and he challenges him. He says, come for a duel with me. And Yama is like, he's laughing. He said, what's wrong with you? You know, I'm death. I mean, I'm the ultimate thing. I mean, you can't come and challenge me. And when he's about to kill Ravana, he says, okay, if a fight is what you want, the fight is what you get. And he says, I'm just going to throw my noose around you and you'll be finished. And just when it is about to happen, it is believed that Lord Brahma manifests there. And he says, no, this is not my plot. He says, Lord Rama has to come and he only has to defeat Ravana. You cannot kill him. Okay, and this is the story. But the inner significance of this is, as we all have spoken many times, Ravana always stands for desire. And the inner significance of this episode is, death can never end desire. He says, because desire goes from lifetime to lifetime, death can never end desire. Only Rama can come and end desire, which means the Atma or the Atma Vichara can put an end to desire.
As Swami would say, only Rama can end karma.
Right. And that can happen only when you make this conscious choice. When you use your vijnana or your discrimination and say that, I'm not going to turn towards desire, I'm turning towards the Atman. And only that can put an end to desire. So that choice becomes higher than even this desire which is pulling you.
Because the choice can overrule the desire.
Absolutely.
Or it can give expression to the desire. In fact, I remember Swami saying it, that all the sadhana that we do is for chitta shuddhi, purifying the chitta. Chitta, which is actually part of the manas. That time, as I said, we didn't go into the parts of the manas and the details. We accepted manas as the mind, but it is much more than that. But Swami says all this is for purity. Why? Because when that purification process happens, you are able to discriminate properly and decide good from bad, right from wrong, dharma from adharma. Therefore, sadhana as such doesn't help us achieve God. Sadhana becomes a tool. When we do sadhana, we get purity. When that purity comes in, you're able to discriminate better. And when you're able to discriminate, you're able to choose the right desires which will take you along, not only in the physical evolution and the evolution of the mind, but also in the evolution of the soul. Last time we spoke about how science ends with material evolution and evolution of life. But there is also a third evolution, which is spiritual evolution, which it doesn't give importance to. And all our scriptures is all about giving importance to this evolution, which alone makes life fulfilled and complete. And that is why Bhrigu comes and says, Dad, you know, I was wrong thinking that mind, which is a bundle of desires, it is the ultimate driving force. There is something that controls the mind also. That is what Swami would often say as, master the mind, be the mastermind. And that mastermind is nothing but vijnana, knowledge. Knowledge is God. We have heard it oftentimes. Knowledge is the ultimate. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is God. And this knowledge, meaning discriminatory knowledge, is the ultimate. It is the basis for creation. It is what sustains creation. It is what dissolves creation. It is what helps us choose the way to end this chain, the iron chain and the gold chain. Because, as you said, death cannot put an end to desire, but Rama can. And it is discrimination that can make desire, kama, turn towards Rama. We spoke about it also when Sita chooses the golden deer, she separated from Rama. And Swami would often say, when desire, kama comes in, you get separated from Rama. So when you choose to focus on God, choose to focus on Rama, that is when you can actually annihilate or give up kama. Till then you cannot. Death cannot make you give up kama, but discrimination can, by making you turn towards Rama or God. And therefore, this vijnana is the ultimate.
And the other thing, if you look at it, there is no other way you can explain a soul traveling from the mineral life, the animal life, to the human birth, to going beyond, to that of coming alive as divine. Now, there's a very, very beautiful, I can't quote it verbatim, a poem by Rumi, you know, the Sufi saint Rumi. He says that, you know, I died a mineral, I was born a plant. I died a plant, I was born an animal. I died an animal, I was born a man. I died a man, I became an angel. And I died an angel and I went to life beyond. Something like that. It's very, very beautiful. So you cannot explain this evolution if you do not talk about an overbearing intelligence which says that I have to travel forward, I have to go forward. So it is not just being propelled by desire alone, but there is an, you know, overruling intelligence which says that, okay, now you've enjoyed this part. Now you'll have to go to something higher. So now when Bhrigu comes and says that Vijnana is ultimate, he's saying that there is something which is driving this whole creation, you know, and that is this knowledge, this Vijnana, this desire to seek itself or know itself. That is what is driving this whole thing. So that is the basis of entire life.
But, you know, before we go into what happens next, I think there's another beautiful song. The song is very apt here. It's a composition by Mirabai. It is apt here because she is stating the eternal truth that you may have desires for anything in life. The mind desires whatever it thinks is valuable. But more valuable than all the treasures in life is the treasure of the Lord's name. Because this is a treasure that nobody can steal from you. Not only in this birth, but across lifetimes, across births. This treasure will remain forever with you, and therefore seek this treasure alone. This is a song that encourages us to, you know, discriminate and choose our desires wisely. Dear listeners, don't go away anywhere. On the other side of the song, we'll come to the exciting conclusion of this whole episode between Bhrigu and Varuna.
पायो जी मैंने राम रतन धन पायो पायो जी मैंने राम रतन धन पायो पायो जी मैंने राम रतन धन पायो पायो जी मैंने वस्तु अमोलिक दी मेरे सतगुरु वस्तु अमोलिक
Thank you.
So welcome back, dear listeners. As we have reached the climax of our discussion, when Bhrigu comes to Varuna, his father, and says that this discrimination, this jnana, this knowledge, wisdom, this is the ultimate. And the father says, you're almost there, son, but you're not there yet. Because that is not the answer. Go do tapas again. And this time, Bhrigu goes and again does tapas, at the end of which, you know, he is in such bliss having got the answer. He comes running to his father and he says, Dad, I know the answer. And this time when he says, he seems to be having a calm demeanor. He doesn't seem excited as such, because he seems to be in a different sort of mood altogether. And all this is not there in the Bhrigavali. I'm just saying because this is how it would appear it would have been, because we will see later on this is what happens. He comes and tells his father the following.
Ānando brahmetibhyajānār ānandājyeva khalvimāni bhūtāni jāyante ānandena jātāni jīvante ānandam prayantyabhisam viśamtiti
That was his declaration, and he comes and says that I have discovered that ananda or bliss is the basis of everything else. It's a very interesting conclusion he comes to. You know, after all that travel, he says that food and mind and vijnana and prana, and finally he comes and says ananda is that which is the basis of everything else. Probably to understand this progression itself, there's this beautiful analogy from the Kathopanishad, which kind of describes this whole thing, you know, where they say the example of a chariot. You know, you have this chariot and the horses are the senses. Okay. And the one who is driving the charioteer is the buddhi, which is very close to the vijnanam, which we spoke about. And the mind, which we gave so much importance to, they say is the reins of the horse. Okay. And why is the mind the reins? If the sense pulls stronger, the reins will go towards the senses. If the charioteer pulls stronger, the reins will come towards the charioteer. So it has no existence of its own. Okay, and then the charioteer is the Atma. Now if you look at it, they say that, you know, the senses are the horses. If you allow the horses to go their way, the horses will be drawn by whatever it is attracted to. So let's say there's something which is there for it to eat, or something which is drawing its attention, the horses will travel in its direction, which probably you could, you know, very loosely relate to the food aspect which we spoke about. That which feeds the senses is the food. So anything which can draw the attention of the horses outward can be spoken about as a food. So then we said that no, food is not the ultimate one. It is in the mind. And when we talk about the mind, you're talking about the combination of these reins and the horses together. Because that is the one which is driving the whole chariot together. I mean, chariot forward. And then he says, no, it is not the manas, it is not the food, but it is the vijnanam. The charioteer who is sitting there, he has the control. But the Kathopanishad says, but this charioteer also serves one who is actually traveling in the chariot. And that is the Atman. So now you're talking about a scenario where there is this charioteer who's serving the person who is sitting in the thing. And it is like saying, Lord, tell me your wish. I am going to do what is your command. So you can see this whole thing is based on one person's will, or one person's, you know, the whole apparatus is to please one being. He's saying, what pleases you pleases me. And this whole thing is so that I can give you happiness. Tell me what you like.
Beautiful, beautiful analogy. And naturally, it is there from the Kathopanishad. Right. It has to be perfect in all the sense. You know, I feel one thing we have to clarify here, because the time is running out, is that when we say Ananda, Bhagwan is Ananda Swarupa, it doesn't mean a person who is jumping in joy always. It's not, that is different. It is different from happiness and it's different from excitement. Ananda is something different, and I feel the best way to explain Ananda would be to again make use of Swami's own words. Swami, make use of Swami's analogy. Swami says that people, when we say Sachitananda, Sachit Ananda, Sachit Ananda, Sachitananda Swarupudu, God is Sachitananda Swarupa. What is Sachit Ananda? Swami says Sat. Sat means being. That is existence. That is like water, Swami says. And then Chit. Chit is awareness. And Swami would often add, not ordinary awareness, constant integrated awareness. We'll come to that a little later. But Swami says Chit or awareness is like sugar. When you put sugar in water and mix it thoroughly, it becomes a sweet sugar syrup. Swami would say this sugar syrup is ananda. So therefore, ananda or bliss can be defined as a combination of sat and chit. Sat is being or existence, which all of us have by default. And chit is awareness. You know, this awareness goes beyond discrimination also. For example, why vijnana cannot be the ultimate is also because vijnana seems to be the exclusive property of humans alone. Animals can't discriminate. So does it mean that God or the ultimate basis of everything is the exclusive property of man alone? No, God is all inclusive. So therefore, though vijnana is very subtle compared to the other three, and it is phenomenal and it is a directing force, there has to be something that is all-inclusive. And this all-inclusive thing is awareness. Therefore, awareness should not be confused with discrimination. See, awareness is more like when we read about Swami's birth. We read how when Swami was born, musical instruments played on their own. When Krishna was born, nature celebrated. How is nature able to celebrate? Nature doesn't have discrimination. It doesn't have knowledge. It doesn't know. In the same way, how do musical instruments which are dead know about the birth of the avatar? So there is something that permeates this consciousness, or this awareness is there. That seat of awareness is bliss. And therefore Swami would clarify saying, not ordinary awareness, but constant integrated awareness. Because, you know, you would have experienced it, I have experienced it. Here and there in our life, when we suddenly become aware of that one force, energy, Atma, God, Swami, whichever, that's permeating everything, we are actually in a state of equanimity and serenity. You know, it's almost like you see a lady hitting a baby and you get angry on the lady. The minute you get to know that it's a mischievous child and the lady is the mother, your perception changes, because you know that the mother is all love and she won't hit the baby simply. What made the difference here? Awareness. In the same way, when we are aware that everything is one, it is the same force permeating all, then our concept of joy and sorrow totally changes. It becomes everything merges into one. And we actually experience that awareness now and then in our life. That is why Swami would say, not ordinary awareness. Ordinary awareness is not enough. It will make you blissful. It will give you ananda for only 5 minutes every day. What you need is constant integrated awareness. That awareness should be constant, lasting throughout the day, and integrated. It should be integrated with each other's awareness, you know, this way. Then alone you will be able to enjoy uninterrupted, unalloyed ananda, which is that sugar syrup.
And looking at this conclusion which has come to ananda, you know, now when you say that ananda is the basis, because now when he comes and tells his father, does he come back to his father, or is he satisfied with the answer himself?
Actually, I'm also not very clear on this, because the way each para ends, you know, that end is not there for ananda.
So I think that is another sign where he does not see the need to go and get validation for this answer which
exactly.
He has got. But if you now look at the conclusion that he says the bliss is the basis of everything else, now when you look back at everything, every other stage which he came across, the body which was represented by the food, the manas and the prana and all of these, even vijnana, now when you look at it, each of these become a tool for finding that bliss.
Exactly.
You know, we search for bliss, we don't realize it, we search for happiness and bliss through food. We search for happiness and bliss through our expression of life. We search for that happiness through our thinking, through our discrimination, through our, you know, the joys which we get. As we said, the desires is nothing for the body but for the mind. So we seek for this bliss through all this. And when Swami says that constant integrated awareness, when you know that this is the basis, and the idea is he has found that ananda is the very nature of this substratum or this, you know, being which you're searching for, then you realize that I already am happy. There is nothing to search for. And the restlessness suddenly seems to have vanished because there is no progression.
Exactly. You know, I think we had this discussion also. The greatest paradox in the pursuit of happiness is that happiness is not a pursuit. As Swami says, we are all ananda swarupas. We are born out of ananda and we dissolve back into ananda. So what matters is what we do in between the birth and dissolution. And throughout our life, we are always in the quest of this happiness, because we confuse ananda to be happiness. That is why we make our choices. Even an animal, its instincts is all driven by what will make it happy. That is what an animal is always seeking. It knows that satiating the hunger will give it joy. That's why it wants to satiate hunger. Man is able to overcome that with discrimination, because he feels that by giving up my food and concentrating on my work, maybe I'll progress my career, because he feels a career will give him a greater joy, a kind of a higher joy compared to food. Therefore, he is able to make the trade-off. But even while making the trade-off, he is aiming for a higher joy only. But the highest joy comes from the awareness that everything is one. And that awareness is something that we have to build into us to be constant and integrated. Every time anything happens, can our first reaction be, you know what, this is God, that's also God, this is God's doing, everything is God. Never, it's very, very tough. I feel all our sadhanas should be towards that, towards trying to come to that awareness. That should be our first reaction. Somebody comes and tells you got the first rank, congratulations. Before getting, jumping in joy, everything. If we are able to bring this awareness in, even at an intellectual level to start off with, I think we will find equanimity in life. And as Bhagavan Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, among all the devotees, the one who is equanimous, sukha dukhe samay kritva labha labhav jaya jayo, he is the one that is dearest to me, Arjuna. So there again is another hint. And as you said, you know, the greatest validation of this truth is he doesn't seek validation. Having got this, he doesn't care whether the father says that, right, you got the correct answer or not. It doesn't matter at all because I'm already experiencing it. As you said, the intellect is only one of the tools. The ultimate is the experience. And once you experience, you don't seek validation from the intellect, from the mind, nothing. And then you realize it is ananda that the mind is seeking, it's ananda that discrimination is seeking. It is ananda which is the basis for food and our life itself.
And probably we'll end with one analogy which Swami gives, you know. There was a devotee who was asking this question to Swami. Swami, what is this thing which you say that you are divine? You know, I'm not able to experience that. I'm not able to feel it. What way is it that you're saying that I'm divine and I'm one with you? And Swami quickly looked around to the interview room and Swami looked at the bulb. Okay. And Swami said, you see that bulb? Okay. The bulb can be of any wattage. Swami would say, you know, 4 watts, 5 watts, 10 watts. You know, there is the bulb which gives the light, and the cause for that light is the current which runs. Okay. And Swami said, right now you're thinking you're the bulb. All that I'm saying is you're not the bulb, you're the current. And that's all matters. In another occasion, Swami says, you have the ocean and you have waves that keep forming on it. All I'm saying is stop thinking that you're the wave and believe that you're the ocean.
You're the water, huh?
Right? Waves will come and go. You'll again form another wave. You'll again form and take a different shape. But the moment you get this fixed in your eye, in your head, that I'm not a wave, but I am the ocean. That's all it is. And that's all matters.
And the shift is so paradigm. The minute you think you're a wave, you have a birth, you have a life, you have a death. The minute you know the ocean, you don't even keep track of how many waves, what, nothing. It's just existence. Existence with awareness. Sat with chit that gives rise to ananda. Ananda which is the basis of entire creation of everything as discovered by Bhrigu and as discovered intellectually by us. Hopefully we pray to Swami that we can make this part of our being so that we too become Anandamaya just like He is the Anandamaya Bhagavan.
So that, dear listeners, brings us to the end of this week's afternoon satsang as well as this topic which we took up. Bhrigu Ali, we would love to hear from you what you thought about this discussion. I'm sure we've not had the last word. This is just an attempt at an interpretation of this immense text. And we do hope that it would have interested some of you at least to go back and read some of these wonderful works, the Upanishads and what is called as Vedanta philosophy. We offer this humble effort of ours at Swami's lotus feet. Till we meet you all next week, this is Arvind and Prem from Team Radio Sai signing off. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, you just heard an episode of our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai, at 12:30 PM Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia Stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 5th November 2015. Dear listeners, we hope you liked this program. As always, send us your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you and loving Sai Ram from Prashant Nilayam.